Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
It's the Round Ball Rock Podcast, starring Dave Schilling, Tony Parker, JaVale McGee, Joey Devine, Wayman Tisdale, Jason Kidd, Sean Keane, Troy Daniels, Serge Ibaka, how hungry are you for music? Special guest, Claire DeLune, Patreons, Laurent Cassol, merci Laurent, Silky Johnson, thank you Silky, Bone Wet Video, thank you BWV, musical guest MB35, and now the temporary host of Round Ball Rock, Joey Devine.
Hi, it's me, Joey Devine, your temporary host of the Round Ball Rock podcast, and we are back with a brand new episode. I'm here, as always, the America's Uncle Dad, America's Uncle, first time visiting Europe this week, Sean Keane. How are you, Sean?
I'm good. I'm scouting podcast talent. That's what this is about. It's summertime. Me and Fran Fraschilla are going to be just breaking down some hurling podcasts. It's going to be great. visit all the podcasting hotspots of London, Amsterdam, and Dublin, where they record the most unintelligible podcasts outside of Glasgow.
All right, so let's. Sean's got to catch a plane here in a few minutes to be a world traveling man. So let's get straight to our episode. We had Claire DeLune, basketball writer, Twitter personality, all around
journalist, former bandmate of Lizzo,
but more importantly, a musician signed to the Golden State Warriors record label.
I love that so much.
So, weirdly, we're doing two music episodes back to back. But anyway,
it's nice to actually talk about enjoyable music. I almost feel like we had to do this, or those James Dolan songs would still be kicking around our heads.
Anyway, here's our conversation with Claire about a wide-reaching variety of topics, including some basketball.
Some of us maybe show how old we were by what music blogs we might have been reading in the early 2000s.
We're here with Claire DeLune, also known as Tiny Deaths, to talk about what it's like to be a musician, but more importantly, what it's like to be a musician signed with the Golden State Warriors entertainment. Claire, how are you doing?
It is a really cool full circle kind of meeting of my disparate worlds. I think I had sort of I've been a recording artist since I was a teenager, and I got into the NBA like completely as a hobby, kind of turned into a side or like a secondary career or whatever, kind of by accident really, for me. And then in like 2022, last year, is when I started having conversations with the Warriors, with Golden State Entertainment, they kind of like merged. And it was really funny because the CEO of the label basically found me because he followed me on Twitter for NBA stuff, for my NBA tweets. And then I posted about my music and he was like, oh, she's a musician too. And then like, that's how he found Tiny Death. So it's pretty crazy. It came full circle. It's a very strong endorsement for spending too much time on your hobbies. Because my NBA basketball obsession ended up being quite helpful for my music career. So yeah.
Yeah, I was primarily doing stand-up and just joke writing stuff. And then NBA stuff became like half my profession as well.
It's so funny how it just takes over like that.
It's funny, too, because I didn't connect that you were the same. Because I used to listen to, this is an older song, The Gardener. I had it on a bunch of playlists.
Oh my God. That's so cool.
But I didn't actually make the connection because I was like, oh, this is Tiny Desk, you know. I don't know. Anyway, it was like, I think I was following you on Twitter for basketball stuff for like a year before I made the connection.
That's so funny. That song, I feel like this is like, well, age us both, but because that song came out in, I think, maybe like 2015 or something around
that
there.
That's right. Yeah.
And that was like still pretty peak blog times, or at least like the tail end of the peak. And I remember it got a write up in Stereo Gum, which was like a really big deal at the time. I mean, we're going on like 10 years ago now. But that song ended up getting like a lot of traction. Like my first manager, who's not my manager anymore, but who was managing Tiny Desk at the time, found me from that Stereo Gum write up. Like it was definitely a time where like one song could pop off, like on the internet without any use of social media.
I feel like it's such a time gone by
because I feel like either TikTok or like algorithmic playlists or whatever are pretty much the only way people like discover.
Absolutely. Well, it's a weird thing too, because like I always think about like that, the MP3 blog era as almost having its like own specific genre of music too, where it's like, like, I remember ordering, like, a Clap Your Hands and Say Yeah album because I heard, like, and it was just a really strange
mini era
of music. It feels like that only existed for 5 years.
I mean, it was such a again, with the aging myself, but I graduated high school in 2007. And so they say that, you know, you're like late teens, early 20s are kind of like the era in music that you will like feel the most fondly about and like be the most nostalgic about forever, and that you kind of consider like the pinnacle. And so I realized that I'm biased, but I think that like that times between like, I would say like 2005, 2015, like that 10-year span from when I was like, you know, 16 to like 26, is like such a, what was such a magical time in independent music, because it was like all the sort of like streaming and all that stuff was like brand new. Like, like I feel like I'm sitting on my front porch in a rocking chair, but like we didn't have Spotify when I was in high school. So like you had to like purchase things to hear them or hear them on the radio. So it was like, there was like this kind of renaissance of like music discovery, but it was before all the major labels had kind of figured out how to hack into the mainframe of how to like take over what you heard, and like how the kind of people in who had historically always been in control learned how to regain control of what the public was hearing.
Yeah.
So I feel like there was just so much cool indie music that, you know, was popular during that time, and that I learned about from blogs and from like people who are like professional tastemakers, like people whose careers had been dedicated to like the circulation of new music. Whereas now I think it's definitely more in the hands of just like the general populace, which is good and bad. I mean, there's pros and cons to that, but there's like, I feel like there's fewer like tastemakers who are like curating like, oh, I found this new song by Tiny Desk called The Gardener, and they're like a completely unknown project out of Minneapolis, like, but we're gonna put it on this blog, you know. Now I feel like it's more like if things go viral or, you know, like kind of more organically on social and stuff, that's how people hear them. or if like the three people who make playlists at Spotify and Apple Music put it in a playlist, that's how you hear it. But those people are, you know, obviously like being fed and influenced a lot of stuff by like these huge, powerful labels who have reps who like whole job is to take the people who make these playlists out to dinner. You know what I mean?
And yeah, like, it's almost weirdly like we've returned back to
radio.
Yeah,
it's literally we're like back in radio in like a weird way, except for with this interesting sidebar thing that none of the like adults in the room can figure out, which is that like things will just go viral on TikTok.
Yeah,
and I mean, the labels are desperately trying to figure out how that works and like how to reverse engineer that, but they haven't, to be honest with you. Like, I mean, like, you know, on my old label, they would come to me and be like, oh, this person just went viral doing this, you should do something similar. And I'd be like, no, like, it's not going to work when I do it. It's going to look like, hello, fellow kids. Like, that's what it's going to look like. If I try and do this thing, like, the whole point is that people gravitate towards something for kind of unnamed like ephemeral reasons,
yeah,
and then it blows up, and that's cool, and I feel like that will probably pass at some point too. Like, we're in that kind of sweet spot,
right? They're gonna figure out how to pay TikTok creators
and they have already
yeah,
you know, but we kind of are still in that, like, I would say like the 2014 blog equivalent of that with TikTok right now where things are just kind of happening magically and like no one really understands how. And I'm good with that. Even if it doesn't benefit me directly, I feel like that's cool. That's cool. That's way cooler to me than like, you know, like labels making sure that things get placed on certain playlists and things like that. That's more like old school radio vibes, which I think it went away for a reason. You know?
Yeah. I like it when it's just a completely random song that does that. Like, I just love that the Mountain Goats had to start.
I know. Had to learn what TikTok was. Yeah. I love that. I have a few friends who are in bands that never, you know, got very big. I mean, I know I have a friend from Minneapolis who is in a band who had broken up, like we're done, like years prior. And one of their songs randomly like went extremely viral on TikTok. They generated, you know, like tens of millions of plays on Spotify and stuff, and so they like got back together and went on tour. And it's like kind of a, I don't know, there's something sort of like, on the one hand there's something kind of depressing about like how little control we have over the trajectory of our own careers when you're in music, because it's just such a fucking crapshoot at the end of the day. So that's kind of depressing, but it's also kind of heartwarming that, like, you know, there is this weird world we live in now where like a really catchy song or like something that has like a lot of merit like can kind of find its way to the surface against all odds. Like, I really think in like the you know, history of music, there has been like more of like, there is at least a gatekeeper, you know, who has to like give you the stamp of approval. Historically, they used to have to give you money to make music, but they don't really do that anymore. Yeah, right. Even if they give you the stamp of approval, it's more sort of like, cool, I'm going to like, you know, make sure people see this. But there used to be like, they would, you know, find undiscovered artists and develop them and kind of decide like, okay, Bruce Springsteen, you have a lot of promise. We're going to like give you a budget to make an album. And that doesn't really happen so much anymore, but it's a lot easier or like a lot more possible, I guess, to have people just like magically find you, which is kind of cool in its own right. So,
yeah. And now you're relying on Mike Dunleavy Jr., right? That's he's managing your career. That's his job.
I mean, so it's funny because when I tell people that I'm signed with Golden State Entertainment, I think they kind of picture it like Steph Curry is like A&Ring my album, But it is like a separate entity. Like, it's owned by the same parent, like Golden State Warriors parent company. But like the people who run the label are not also running the basketball team. So, but there is overlap, which is crazy. Like the person who does my PR is also doing PR for the basketball team. So it's a very like bizarre, interesting situation that I'm in, but cool, super cool. And like I have a meeting this week. And it's at Chase Center, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So,
Well, so, they have a funny group of people in the front office too, because there's like a small number of people that were in the previous regime where the Warriors had this just nightmare owner for 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's so funny that these people that were in this just terrible workplace environment for so long are now just thriving with an organization that has like a budget and an owner that's not afraid to talk to people. Yeah. And
it's a super well-run organization, and like it's super, everyone there is super pro. It's exactly what you would think, you know? I mean, I feel like I have no bad words to say about them at all. They're super good people who are good. Very competent.
Please don't say anything. We do not want to be responsible for you getting dropped because you said something bad on our dumb little podcast.
Are you going to be able to get free tickets? Visit one of the wine cellars?
So I've been to a Warriors game since I signed with them. And my seats were very good, very nice, took good care of me. But it's funny because as an NBA journalist, the other thing that I do, I like get better. I mean, I can sit in a very good seat with my credential as well. Oh, yeah. So so I haven't had to call in too many favors. Like for the playoffs, like I just got credentialed because I was covering the Steph versus LeBron battle, you know? So I didn't really need to ask, which is, again, a very unique position that I find myself in.
Now, I will say, was it weird that after the Warriors lost to the Lakers in the playoffs that Draymond Green called you from his car in the parking lot begging you to sign with Golden State Entertainment?
Yeah, it was a little weird. Also, I thought the chair under the door in my house was like a little bit of overkill. I actually haven't met any of the players, like as a journalist or as a assignee to Golden State's label. I've never met a Warrior. So,
well, I'm sure Draymond has heard you on podcasts. Yeah, that's his.
I think I will meet some of them eventually because I think they're trying to do more like, you know, integrative marketing kind of stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. And as a journalist, I probably will meet them eventually doing that.
Well, also, Steph Curry is now embarking on a musical career, so there could be some synergy there.
That was the best moment of my life. Like, it's like, you know, when like historical things happen, like bad historical things, you're like, I remember exactly where I was. Like, I remember exactly where I was when someone tweeted at me a link to Steph Curry singing with Paramore.
Well,
like,
I have the clip here. So for any of our listeners, let's run the clip. Yeah. All right, that's probably enough.
Is it?
Yeah.
I love it so much. Let's talk about a confluence of my interests. That's like my career in a nutshell.
Sean and I were actually talking about when this clip came out, not to date me and Sean, who are both very old. Paramore is like a thing I missed entirely.
Okay.
Like, I remember Misery Business, and that's it. And then suddenly this clip came out and everyone was talking about how Paramore was like one of the most important bands to their life. And then I was like on their Wikipedia and I was like, oh man, this is like No Doubt. I thought this was just like a one hit wonder tiny emo band, but this is like a huge important band to people. So first off, you're a professional singer.
Yes.
How do you feel about Steph's? How do you feel about Steph's vocal performance there?
I thought he killed it. Yeah. I'm not even being facetious at all. I thought he was amazing. He was like, it's also, this is like getting into the weeds of like nerdy musical shit, but like it's the intro to when he was singing, right? There's like an extended like instrumental solo before that part, and it's mostly bass and drums. There's not a whole lot of melody happening, and he came in exactly in key. which is actually really hard to do because like there's not very many like cue notes happening in the instrumental to indicate like where you're supposed to be singing. So as a singer, I was like, that is so impressive that he just and what that indicates to me is either that he does have some musical talent and or that this song is like so pivotal and important to him that like, you know how sometimes like if you're just singing a song like in like a cappella, if you know it well enough, like you'll cue up the song and you'll be like, oh, this is like exactly right. Like I was already in the key of the song. It's because it's like that muscle memory.
I do not know how that feels because I have zero musical talent at all, but yes.
I'm like, maybe that isn't me. I'm like, I guess I've only experienced music as a singer, but yeah, like I think it indicates that he definitely has some musical talent. Also, I thought his stage presence was amazing, which actually kind of makes sense because he is a performer. He performs basketball, but he's used to like being in front of a large crowd and like entertaining them. But I thought he looked so comfortable on stage. He was like, he just looked like a rock star. I was like so impressed. Normally when NBA players get on stage, because it happens a lot with rappers, right? Like NBA players get on stage, they look like such herbs once they're in a rap show. And he really like he just absolutely killed it. And I think it's really funny because it's a historical truth that like rappers wish they were ball players and ball players wish they were rappers. It's like this weird like grass is always greener thing. It was really interesting because that's not true obviously about like pop punk from the early 2000s. Like it's not interchangeable that way, but it was so cool watching. I had a tweet go kind of viral that was just like a link to this clip basically. And it was so interesting watching like Paramore fans discover the NBA. Like, they were just like, they were like, oh, I think I'm going to start watching basketball now. This guy seems really cool. And I was just like, this is incredible.
He's clearly a big fan of Ben because I think 5 years ago he had whenever his 30th birthday was, I think.
Yeah, they played at his birthday.
Yeah. And we're like, he was so into it. So clearly he had been on board for a while.
Yeah.
And
we're around the same age. Like it makes perfect sense to me. Like Misery Business, the song he was singing in that clip was, I think, I was either like a junior or senior in high school when that song came out. And I think he's like maybe a couple of years older than me. So yeah, like that was very formative musical times for us. That song was massive too. I don't know if you guys, I mean like,
no, it's just, I'm like 2 years too old basically. Because like in like 2003 to 2006 was the prime time of me just searching out the most new music I could. And, kind of being a little lonely and mostly doing comedy. So I would like listen to these giant playlists and blog late at night, you know, like that was, but yeah, so it probably, I like just missed it basically.
But this is also, I feel like this wasn't like cool music at the time. Like it definitely wasn't like Pitchfork approved.
Yeah. And that's how I missed it. I was like stuck in, because I was,
it's like on TRL.
Yeah, I was big into the first part of emo, like Cursive and Bright Eyes and the kind of stuff. And then
so like the Saddle Creek.
Yeah, so embarrassing. But yes.
A lot of that stuff's really good. I don't want
to. Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. It's just it was an embarrassing part of my personality, I would say, as a young person trying to find himself.
But you didn't make it all the way to like Dashboard Confessional.
I had the first Dashboard album, but
I referenced one of those songs a lot.
Once,
the like screaming infidelities.
Yeah. Like once Dashboard was on MTV, I was like, sell out. Bye.
I wasn't like I would say my wheelhouse, like I wasn't like a scene kid. Like, so like there was a whole thing in, you know, when I was like in high school, like there was like scene kids. They had like the swoopy side hair with the one streak of platinum in it and like a million bracelets and like all that stuff. And like Paramore was sort of like the like biggest of those bands. And I wasn't like a scene kid. Like that wasn't I was more, I would say I was more like maybe somewhere in between you and that, where my favorite bands were like Yeah Yeahs and like Grizzly Bear and whatever. So it was definitely like the kind of like, Stereo Gum, Pitchforky, like bloggy bands. And I like hung out in a coffee shop a lot. And, you know, it was like that. That was definitely more my vibe in high school. But I think Paramore was just like, it was like, you know, such a quintessential band to that time.
Yeah.
Of for people of a certain age, that I think it's like part of it is they were always really good and they weren't taken seriously because they were popular. So it was a time where like if you I feel like now actually like Pitchfork will review like Olivia Rodrigo's record or something, like there is a little more intersection between the sort of like highbrow musical taste and like pop.
I actually have a problem with how Pitchfork has done that too.
Well, no one really cares about Pitchfork.
Exactly. Anymore, but what that was sort of my problem is when they went back and re-reviewed all those albums, it was like embarrassing.
So pretentious and embarrassing. Yeah.
It's like terrible. So embarrassing.
It's like you were too cool for it then. So you're just so like die on that hill. Dude.
Right. And like, but you also you're like erasing your website's history. Like it's important for like what Pitchfork was that they gave Liz Phair's album a zero. Like you guys were assholes. Like you can't go back and erase that.
I feel like, yeah, they just need to own how pretentious they were. And it was informed a lot. Like you think about it, kind of was like quite influential that you weren't allowed to like pop music and be like a, you know, like a notable, like cool, like tastemaker journalist at that time.
Yeah.
I think we've kind of like maybe due to like TikTok and sort of like the wholesomeness of it, or maybe due to like, who knows, like just the globalization of the world, we've kind of like accepted that people can contain multitudes and you can like really, really like, you know, like Billie Eilish or like whatever, like,
yeah,
interesting thing is on pop radio. And you can also be like, My Bloody Valentine is my favorite band. And that's not like a contradiction. It's just like, mm-hmm, you can like more than one thing.
But I actually think we've gone a little too far that way in like, because I heard actually a critic for the New York Times talking about music criticism on a podcast this week and how much it's changed. Now he's like, now I would never write that I don't like this band. And it's like, then what's your job?
Yeah.
Like,
Is it just like stan culture has taken off too much that like you'd be bombarded?
I do think that's part of it.
Yeah,
think they're kind of scared to say bad things about like especially someone like Taylor Swift or someone like that. I feel like it's become like so taboo to like criticize her in any way. I agree with you.
Yeah, it's not unlike criticizing Kobe on Twitter. Anyway, keep going.
but that's a good point, because I think the reason I disagree with you a little bit is that I think like it's true that it's less socially acceptable to just like malign people. And I think that's maybe okay. Like, I feel like people talk about that with basketball too. They're like, oh, like you can't like say a player's trash anymore. I'm like, well, but none of them are trash because they're like the most talented people in the world.
Yeah.
And they are playing in the NBA, which is like basically impossible to do, especially if you're not like from, if you're not Steph and your dad didn't play in the NBA, like the chances of you actually making it is just so, so infinitesimal. And even if your dad was in the NBA, you could be like Shareef O'Neal, who, you know, did pretty good at Summer League last year and never made an NBA roster. So like, it's so hard to do. And I feel like music's the same way. Like it's so hard to get your music heard. It's essentially, it's mathematically impossible to have more than like 100 people ever hear whatever you do as a musician. Mm-hmm. So I do think that the fact that people have to like take pause before they just shit all over something is like maybe okay. And maybe good even, but there is probably like a happy medium where you should be able to insightfully and with kindness critique
exactly
and say what you don't like about something.
Yeah,
and hopefully we'll kind of end up somewhere in the middle. I think it was like, yeah, like to your point, maybe a little bit of an overcorrection, but I like that people can't just like blindly shit all over things anymore.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially because, not to be like the as a woman, but like as a woman, a lot of it was hella sexist.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, so no, like absolutely. Oh, yeah. I'm not pining for the days of shitting on Liz Phair or whatever, but because she made a major label album as an adult,
which
woman.
Was really good, I thought.
Yeah. I just think there is a certain point. In weirdly, Twitter has made it so our culture has become, because I like something, it has to be great art, and it's okay for it not to be. Like, a Marvel movie doesn't also have to win Best Picture because it made all the money in the world. And like,
depending on the Marvel movie, some of them are really good, though.
Yes, no, I like Marvel movies. I'm just saying, like, there was
I know
there was a difference between, you know, I don't know. There's a difference between like art and pop and like pop culture, and that's okay. That we've sort of weirdly lost.
I think I see both sides in that. Like, I think it's okay to enjoy something even though it's not high art. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I agree with you on that, but I also think that historically, a lot of what we've deemed like worthy of being high art and like what we've deemed like this is like has value beyond just like that it's popular appeals to a certain demographic of people. And like there's Jessica Hopper's written a lot of really cool stuff about this, but basically there's been sort of a delineation between like what teenage girls like and listen to and what like everybody else likes and listens to. And the teenage girl taste kind of has been the driver of like what's popular in music culture, etc. What we consider like mass popularity, like mass culture, it kind of stems from like what teenage girls are into. I think that there is like value in taking their tastes and interests more seriously.
Absolutely.
So I would say I'm somewhere in the middle on that.
That's all I'm asking for is some kind of middle ground. I think we've gone a little too far one way.
Well, what I think is interesting, too, is what you were saying about the time when your musical interests get really formed.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's one reason why that's what drives the market is like you're never. Yeah, most of the time, you're never going to be quite as insanely passionate about music as you were.
Right.
Right then. So it's like, yeah, that makes sense that these are the most passionate fans. Although it was kind of amazing to see the flattening of that. Like when you'd see footage of Taylor Swift concerts where it's like you'll see a 15-year-old boy crying next to a 55-year-old woman crying.
Yeah.
With emotion.
Well, she's like such a cultural phenomenon. I actually refuse to weed into to Taylor Swift because I'm just like, I value my life yeah, and livelihood too much. But it is, I do find it fascinating, like, that she's, like, the level of enormity. And, again, to, like, shout out writers that I like that have written about this. Brittany Spanos from Rolling Stone wrote a piece about kind of breaking down how she believes, like, the kind of confluence of events between, like, the pandemic and all these different things that led to Taylor Swift becoming, like, the biggest thing on the face of the planet right now, musical or otherwise, really. Yeah. So. Yeah, now you guys have, don't you love listening to a podcast and getting homework? I've just given you like, it's the best. You're like, I don't want to read. That's why I'm listening to a podcast.
Well, there's a little bit of a common thread, at least with the internet, with NBA stuff too, where it really feels like, you know, back in like 2005, it felt like the most niche thing in the world that someone was writing about. Just enjoying athlete styles, like opposed to. I just remember reading like Free Darko and a little bit of Dime Magazine. Was it? No, it's Slam was a little bit like that too.
With
stuff where you're like, oh, this is just a profile of a guy where they're talking about how awesome his spin moves are and how weird it is to have like a 6'8" guy handling the ball, and there's not. Like it doesn't have anything to do with this playoff performance. And now that seems a lot more acceptable and mainstreamed. And to like talk about how players have feelings.
You know, I know. Who knew? I think just as a world, we are, or at least, you know, as a society, whatever, we're kind of meandering slowly in the right direction, I would say, in a very wobbly fashion of understanding that people, like, it kind of all comes back to like we're just broadening our perspectives of like what we are as people and like what's okay. And like essentially the take home from all this stuff is that like we all contain multitudes, we're not one dimensional. Just because you're good at one thing doesn't mean you're not allowed to be interested in something else. Just because your music's popular doesn't mean it doesn't have value. Just because you're an athlete doesn't mean you don't have feelings. Like we're coming out of a history of just seeing things in a very like binary black and white kind of way. And we're kind of like broadening that slowly and incrementally over time. And so I think that's kind of what you're seeing is like, especially with the NBA, like it is such a like cult of personality in like the best way. Like it's not, that's what made me fall in love with basketball, is it shouldn't be covered like other sports because it's not like other sports. Mm-hmm. Like they don't have protective facial gear covering their faces. Like the arenas are smaller than they would be in like football or soccer or whatever. Like you are kind of up close and personal with these people, and I do feel like NBA players are generally like often more compelling and interesting, than, you know, athletes in a lot of other sports. Like they do have other interests and stuff like that oftentimes. So I think it's good that we're celebrating that. I don't love, you know, obviously some of the like other side of that, which is like these sort of clickbaity stories or like the first take kind of roundtable where it's like about everything except basketball. Like, you know, that stuff gets obviously a little bit tiresome, but I do think it's,
speaking of that, like stan culture and like sexism too, I actually think the way Twitter talks about Malika Andrews now is like disgusting.
Oh, but it's
where it's like, how dare you ask this guy about how he brought a gun to a murder at the draft? It's supposed to be his greatest day, and it's like, it's her job as a journalist, dude, to ask those questions.
It's a time-honored tradition of holding women doing a job to an impossible standard. Like, oh, I would say, like, Rachel got a lot of that, too, you know, when she was in that spot. So it's amazing. Like, I have obviously a lot of, you know, friends who are women who do this job. I have a lot of them are a lot more famous and successful than me, and I see, like, what their mentions looks like and stuff, and even like my friend Kristen Ledlow, who does NBA TV, like even her mentions, and she's like the most, like the least controversial, like most, she's an angel person. Yeah. Like she's literally, she's just like a wonderful, like God-fearing mother who's like gorgeous and beautiful. Like she could not fit more into the box of what these people ostensibly want their like female reporters to be. And she still gets like so much like hate and vitriol just for existing. So it's like, for me, my kind of point of view has always been like, well, what's the point of trying to like fit into, like, screw that. Like you're going to hate me and tell me I'm stupid and I don't know anything about sports no matter what I do.
Right.
So I'm just going to do exactly what I want. And like the chips will fall where they may, kind of a thing. So like I think Malika, to her credit, like she's so smart and passionate and driven. She loves her job so much and she works so hard. I do think that she's able to like, you know, tune some of that stuff out to a degree, but I mean, nobody can tune all of it out, and I'm sure it's exhausting.
Well, and I also think it's partly a reaction. I want to make this very clear. I'm saying this not Claire, who is a credentialed NBA journalist, but I think it's a reaction to the largest NBA reporters now are like access hounds who would never write a story about that would maybe anger an agent or whatever to lose the fact that they could then tweet out a trade 20 minutes before everyone else. But that's just me.
The biggest reporters saying don't that, really not write. But no, it feels like the most famous and biggest reporters don't like really write stories or profiles necessarily.
Yeah, I think you're talking about two different types of NBA. No, I'm serious. Like, I think there's two different breeds of NBA journalists. There's like newsbreakers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's three. There's like newsbreakers, there's like talking heads, mm-hmm. And then there's like people doing actual journalism.
Yeah, people who like to write.
Yeah. Right. And so I think like the Wojes and whatever of the world, like those are like newsbreakers, and their job is to just have access and report on that access. Then there's the people who are, a lot of them are former players whose job is to just make entertaining television.
Yeah.
And so they don't really need to concern themselves with like actual journalism because it's truly not their job. Like they're not like failing at their job. Like they're excelling at their job.
Yeah.
Which is to make TV that people want to watch. And then there's people like, you know, my colleagues who are actually trying to like report on things and like do journalism. And I think all three types do exist still.
I just mean, I think there's for a certain percentage of fans, they follow Woj, they follow Shams, they follow Haynes, and that's the entirety of the NBA journalism they follow. So then when they see a journalist like Malika at the draft asking a player tough questions, it's like, what the fuck? Like, how would you do this?
I don't know. I do feel like, to harken back to our earlier point, I do feel like that's a lot more sexism.
Oh, just like, absolutely, as well. Yeah.
Because I think if it was like Jalen Rose asking those tough questions at the draft, they would just be like, oh, he did such a good job. He was like so firm, you know? But I'm also someone who's just like, I'm not mad at them for not asking tough questions at the draft. Like, we don't watch the draft to do investigative journalism. We watch the draft to watch people's dreams come true. You know what I mean? Like, there's a time and a place. So I don't know. I think it's fine. I'm exhausted by sexism. So like a lot of times when people are like, oh, this is so shocking, I'm just like, welcome to my mentions. Like, this is every day of my life.
Yeah.
There's I like that the NBA draft has swung away from what the NFL draft seems to have done recently, which is to bring up the most tragic moment in anyone's life, like 10 seconds after they got their dream job.
Yeah, I'm just like, why? Like, at least for me personally, like, I don't watch the draft to learn anything. I'm not there to learn. I'm there to just like watch this really joyful moment where someone's dreams come true. And
see, I watch it for Fran Fraschilla. Bring him back, everybody.
You want weird insider European basketball.
I mean, I do like when a player is selected and they have usually like, I think like Jay Billis or whatever, like sitting there and being like, I'm going to translate this because I actually know about college basketball. And so they're like, this guy plays for UConn and he's got great length and his wingspan is crazy. Like, that is helpful because I, as someone who like basically only follows college basketball to participate in a March Madness bracket, like I don't know all these players. So it is interesting to me, but like, yeah, for the most part, I think it's just like a beautiful, I don't know. It's like, it's similar to watching someone get inducted into the Hall of Fame. Like, I don't really care with in their speeches. I just think it's like so emotional and lovely to watch someone's like absolute biggest, most impossible dream become reality in real time. Like, how often do we get to do that? And to like be a voyeur into people's lives and kind of like be there for like their most, their biggest, most meaningful, most joyful moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like, I mean, I don't like really report, like I have never like pitched a story about the draft or anything. Like, I don't really care to like analyze or report on it. I'm just like, I just want to like enjoy it. It's like, for the most part, like quite wholesome and just like lovely to behold.
It's funny too, because the draft is, there's so much of a kind of like mock draft industry and draft commentary, where everybody wants to like give people a score. And so much of the draft is actually just pre-draft stuff where players like are getting interviewed. Well, like, it's just less of like a random, people are always like, oh, they got that guy at 11. They could have got this guy at 13. And it's really like, no, it's not really what you think. Like, you are hiring somebody for a job. Usually you like talk to them and figure out where they want to go a little bit first. And
there's been
exercise everybody's doing on the internet.
Did you hear that? There was a clip of Steven Adams on JJ Redick's podcast talking about his pre-draft process.
Oh, that was so good.
It was so good. And he was just sort of like, yeah, like, I really didn't think they were going to like, I'm not going to do a fake Australian accent or like New Zealand accent, because it's probably would be really offensive. But like, he's just like, yeah, like, I really didn't have any expectations for getting into the NBA. Like, they flew me out for free and put me up in these nice hotels for these pre-draft combines and whatever, and like these workouts, and I got to eat for free. I brought my brothers with me. It was super fun. And then it was crazy because like, I went 12, mate.
Meets who tells him like, you average 6-6 in college, what are you doing? And he's like, I don't know.
And he's just like, I'm just here for a good time, not a long time. And I'm like, I love that. It was amazing.
You get to see some of that. That's one of my favorite things about summer league, is when, because there's a lot of guys who it's very high pressure, you're like trying to make the roster, you're a second round pick or something, but there's something glorious about like the 25-year-old who's there because he went to UCLA and he's already has a contract in the German league, and it's just like a nice payday in Las Vegas for 2 weeks. And they're just like, I like it when the player at Summer League has the same attitude as the average fan at Summer League.
Yeah, this is just fun.
It's July.
Let's just go hang out in Vegas. I love Summer League.
My room's comped, right? Yeah, okay, great.
No, Summer League is my favorite. I love it. The vibes are unmatched, and I've written about this actually, but like it's just because it's the off season, but it's this like really sweet spot in the off season where all of like the biggest trades have probably already happened. Like all like people's rosters are mostly set. So everyone from like the front office to the players are like truly not really working at that moment. Like they actually are done for the year by, you know, mid July. And they're just like all in Vegas hanging out. Yeah. It's glorious. Like All-Star Weekend's not like that. You know, obviously the playoffs, the finals, like even All-Star Weekend, it's like they're not working really because it's like a week off, but it's right in the middle of the season.
Yeah. And the trade deadline.
And the trade deadline's like hovering. Yeah. So it's like, I think, Summer League is really special for that reason. It's just like a lot of optimism, a lot of like good vibes.
We had a funny experience last year at Summer League where, I think Kevin Durant had made his trade request or was about to make his trade request. And so we were constantly seeing Sean Marks talking to people. And it was always like, oh, this trade's about to happen.
Yeah.
You know, Sean Marks is talking to Masai. Sean Marks is talking to this guy. But then you realize, like, actually, they're colleagues who
they're just like friends.
Each other like they could be talking about like they who saw Cirque du Soleil. I don't think they're all seeing Cirque du Soleil, but I'm like
for some reason I think
like Sean Marks might I don't know why.
That tracks. I mean I do think obviously like big deals and things do happen at Summer League, or at least like they get initiated sometimes or whatever, but for the most part it's just like I don't know. And I think that's part of the myth of sports is that all these people like really hate each other and they're all like in battle at all times. And maybe that was like a little truer, you know, in like the 70s and 80s and stuff like that, or even the 90s. But like for the most part, like, yeah, there's people who don't like each other. There's people who have beef. Like that's true in any office politics. There's going to be like, you know, Bob doesn't mess with Laura on the fourth floor or whatever. Like, you know, there's going to be like inter-office politics, but the NBA is really sort of like a one big community with like arbitrary delineations for teams. But like a lot of these people have bounced around from team to team, whether it's on the front office side or player side. And they're friends, they're colleagues. Like they chop it up, you know, even like after a game, you'll see guys if you go to an NBA game, you won't see this stuff on TV. But if you go to a game, you'll see guys like just like chit chatting at the free throw line, like not being like not talking shit to like get in each other's heads, just being like, hey, how's your wife? You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Like, and when you think about how long some of these guys have been playing against each other, too. I mean, I thought it was funny when Chris Paul going to the Warriors is like, there's not really that many players who are considered just outright enemies of a team or fan base. And Chris Paul was really
one of the last ones, which is what makes it funny.
And then they traded for him, and then everyone remembered like, oh yeah, he used to train with Chris Paul and they've even gone on family vacations together. And then you watch them at the All-Star game a couple of years ago, they're both throwing alley-oops to each other. And although it was a little bit refreshing when Draymond Green said that he still wasn't going to like Chris Paul, even though they were teammates. I'm like, okay, that's a throwback. That's what we all imagine. This is, and they're going to, I think they're going to become friends, Joey.
Yeah.
What do you think? They're going to be on a podcast together immediately. Yeah.
Chris Paul's going to have to start podcasting. That's the biggest adjustment he's going to have.
He'd be
make.
Good at it. I think he's good at it.
So, he's actually, it's weird that he doesn't do it very much, but he has, he's just been in so many really weird, fascinating situations that his eventual vanity documentary is going to be really good for Apple in about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, he's super, super smart, too.
Not to change the subject, but Claire, there's one thing I wanted to play for you because you are an NBA expert and a musical expert. And I wanted to ask you, have you ever considered recording a cover of You Can't Touch This where you do multiple impressions that are at least are very dated even at the time? because that is what Dwight Howard did one time.
Back in the day, I'll even down, get down.
You can't touch this.
I'll be back.
You can't touch this.
Break it down.
Oh, yep, that's right. He does.
That was an amazing Arnold. Wow.
Yeah, he does Arnold. He does Charles Barkley. Who else does he do in that song, Sean? Do you remember? Does he do Stan Van Gundy in that song?
Does,
I can't remember.
Does he do Charles Barkley?
He does Barkley for sure.
So his like go to set of impressions is Arnold Schwarzenegger, Shaquille O'Neal, and Charles Barkley,
and Stan Van Gundy.
And
I feel like Van Gundy is kind of nuanced. Like, how would you do Stan Van Gundy? Like, is it just kind of shouty or like?
It's kind of shouty and nerdy. Yeah, he also does. Don't forget, he does Stewie from Family Guy. That is his last impression.
Katie Heindel has made me do conversations between both Van Gundy brothers a couple times on the podcast.
Oh, okay.
Stan is harder than Jeff.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, Jeff. I feel like Jeff, I could maybe do Stan. I mean, yeah, maybe just like a little whiny. They both have kind of like a whininess.
And he has it's the way that he breathes that makes his sound kind of weird. So that is
the key. Impressions, like people who are good at impressions, they're so perceptive of like the little things like that. Because that is really like those little nuances are really what sets like a voice apart. So that's so interesting.
And that is how I would describe. Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, no, you go ahead.
I would describe everything about Dwight Howard as nuance. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, he's not. I mean, I think it's safe to say he's not particularly skilled at impressions. So I think that tracks.
He would disagree.
I was just going to say, I've always been kind of surprised I'm not better at impressions because I'm a singer and like my ear is so trained. I'm very sensitive to like noise and like I can hear like I'm like always the first person to hear when a smoke detector is like running out of batteries. You know what I mean? Like I'm so sensitive to that shit. So I've always been surprised that I'm not better at impressions, but I have like a couple in my pocket. Like any person I think has one or two, but I'm not particularly skilled at them.
Well, now I want to hear who are they? Who are your? You don't have to do them. I will not make you do the impressions, but I want to know who your back pocket impressions are.
They're so like obscure because it's so random when I'm able to successfully do it. Mm-hmm. Like one of them is a character from Daria. If you remember Daria.
Oh, I remember Daria. Yeah.
I'm trying to think who the other ones are. There's like members of my family I'm really good at impersonating. Mm-hmm. I'm not great at it. I'm not great at it, but that's part of why I didn't go into acting. I went into
All right, Sean, is there anything else you want to ask Claire here?
Well, I wanted to play her Steph Curry's college rap to give her another.
We
can do that.
So
I've actually never heard that.
So it's from, they revealed that he did this like public college. So we went to Davidson College in North Carolina.
Yeah.
North Carolina, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And
famously.
So they had this. They had a student like sketch show called The Davidson Show that Steph
he was in sketch comedy.
Well, he's like the basketball
was he like a
player
guest?
They were
This is
but he's on a couple of episodes, so he's very game. And there's like a 4.5 minute rap song about their dining commons. And Steph does an extended verse, I guess I would say.
Here, I'll play the verse here.
Sunday brunch is golden rule, and last night's girl thinks you're a tool. Awkward eye contact just isn't cool, and your boy's call outs are way too cool. The outpost might be open later, but Allison cannot flavor your tater. Chester's DeJour is all I'm here for. Skip class today, and all I could say is,
There you go. Wow. That's what I have. That's the clip I have.
I'm beat red, like in secondhand embarrassment. For the podcast audience, my whole face is flushed just with embarrassment on his behalf. It's interesting to me because like he's clearly made strides in that department because in the Paramore video, like his rhythm is impeccable.
He also does a good lip syncing version of he's in a recent rap video, but he's just lip syncing.
Just lip syncing, which is
I mean, it is a song about him from his documentary. Yeah.
Lip syncing is actually so much harder, I think, than people think it is. Because you have to have everything except the pitch, basically. Like, you have to be on, you have to be on rhythm, and you have to like deliver it the same way. I speak from like having shot music videos where you have to, you don't have to lip sync. Like, you, because it's like the audio is getting dubbed over, like you can sing along if you want to, but it's, you're on set for like, you know, 15 hours or something. So your voice gets kind of tired if you're actually singing every take. So I've tried to lip sync, and it's like really hard to like keep your, to have the movements be exactly matching. But yeah, that was god awful. So I think he chose the right career. I think it's safe to say he doesn't have to have any doubts in his mind. I think, you know, it, it worked out okay for him in the NBA. So
it felt very Steph Curry-ish that his boastful rap is just about striking.
Wait, so he wrote that
with a girl? No, I mean, I think the guys probably read it.
I'm like, there's no way he wrote that.
I don't, zero chance.
The delivery suggests that this was the first and only time he'd ever heard these words. Like, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know if he's actually lip syncing in that video. I think he's maybe just doing it live. I don't know. I don't know how.
Well, I appreciate you guys for sharing that with me. It was something. I don't know what word I would use to describe it, but it was something.
If you had to hear one song again, would it be that one or the Dwight Howard one?
For sure, the Dwight Howard one, because I feel like there were so many impressions that you have alluded to that I didn't get to hear.
Well,
so,
you know what? Hold on, I've got some more. Here we go.
Oh, God.
Our time.
From now on, when you see me, you say that goes to white. He's dope with the kids, and the magic are so hype. Now, why would I ever stop doing this? With the kids on my record, it's a surefire hit. I blocked all kind of shots from D Way to Rudy K.
He's really good, actually. This is good. That's the thing, is like Steph's was like sounded like someone reading off a sheet of paper. Like the swag was on zero. The rhythm was imperceptible. But like Dwight, like, okay, for what he's trying to do, which is like an MC Hammer rap. That's excellent. Yeah. It's like, just who wants to listen to MC Hammer in this year of our Lord 2023? But like, for that type of music, like, I thought he did a really good job.
Yeah, it's unclear who it's for exactly, but yeah, it is like a full album where,
well, it's children. It's for children, right?
But like, I can't imagine children wanting that.
Yeah, I don't know.
What was the album called, Sean? Do you remember? It's called
Shoot for the Stars.
Oh wow.
And it's all like, it all has that like kids bop, kids vocals. Yeah.
Oh, one more question, Claire. So say you're performing a show, a sold out show at the Chase Center, like Paramount was. What NBA player do you want to call up to sing with you?
Oh, I mean, Steph Curry at this point. I mean, I thought that was brilliant. A, because they're at the Chase Center. So like, I mean, it's a I almost said it's a slam dunk, and I wasn't even trying to make a pun, but it's just, puns are just so built into my DNA. First of all, because you're at the Chase, so it's Steph Curry. Second of all, because he did so well. Like, I feel like you'd be hard pressed to find an NBA player who would do a better job than that, I think. But for me, I guess, if it wasn't at Chase, like maybe LeBron, just because I'm such a huge LeBron fan that I would just be selfishly using it as an opportunity to hang out with LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally fair. Joey, if you could have someone come up, an NBA player come up during one of your stand-up sets.
Well, first off, I don't do stand-up anymore. Just want to make everyone make that completely clear for everyone who's trying to book me all the time. I know. It would obviously be Anthony Randolph.
Yeah, that's a good point.
My hero.
We're just using this as an opportunity for our personal heroes to come visit us, as one does.
Sean, what about you?
Oh, for comedy, obviously Blake Griffin, the funniest.
Yeah.
No, I would actually, I mean, it might be Dwight Howard. I think
he would do a pretty good job. I mean,
I think if you're also talking comedy, like Barkley or Shaq too, like that's like Shaq an easy slam dunk one.
I think I would pick Shaq because I think I would most want to meet Shaq of any NBA player.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily my favorite, but I feel like he's the best one to meet.
And he like DJs and stuff. Like he knows how to like put on a performance. That's the thing, is a lot of these guys, when they get on stage with these rappers to do these like appearances or whatever, they just kind of like turn into fans and kind of like wither. You need somebody who's like comfortable being on stage.
Yeah,
for sure.
And Shaq is not actually a bad rapper. He's just, you know, not a very notable rapper, I guess I would say.
Who do you guys think is the best NBA rapper? I feel like, I honestly feel like Damian Lillard is like actually really good at rapping. I mean, I don't reach for his music.
I think it's Marvin Bagley. I'm not even kidding. I think Marvin Bagley's the best NBA rapper, at least currently.
Yeah. I would say the guys who are the best at music, it's probably JaVale McGee, I think.
Interesting.
Well, he actually like got a Grammy nomination for, he wrote a Justin Bieber song.
Did he really?
And then Chris Webber has written, I think there's two Nas songs that Chris Webber wrote. But I think they did, I don't think they did like the lyrics. I've heard Chris Webber's rap album and it's,
I just remember I listened to one of Damian Lillard's records. I think it was like during the, like in 2020 or something. And I remember being like quite impressed with like his skill as a rapper. I was like, oh,
spends
like,
a lot of time on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it
like you can tell. Like
he's much of a vanity project.
I think he's really good. I mean, I don't know if he's good enough that he would like have been famous off of just rap if he wasn't an NBA player, but I don't think he's embarrassing himself at all. Like, I think he's a really good rapper.
I'll tell you who the worst NBA rapper is, though. It is Jason Kidd. He's on this like mid-90s compilation. He has a song called What the Kid Did.
Oh, no.
It's really bad.
He has some line about rocking like Jim Kelly, the old Buffalo Bills quarterback. It's really incredible. He sounds like he's like about to fall asleep.
Did you guys know that Jay-Z wrote the Bugs Bunny rap from Space Jam?
That's surprising.
That's one of my favorite. Like, re-listen to that song. The it's called Ya Buggin'.
Uh-huh.
Of course it is. But if you re-listen to that song with like the fact that Jay-Z wrote it in mind, it just adds a whole nother layer of richness to it, because it's actually very like you're like, oh yeah, this is like very well written, but it's just like you don't notice it's well written because it's being wrapped in the voice of Bugs Bunny and it sounds so ridiculous. But Jay-Z wrote that.
We might have to review the Space Jam soundtrack coming episode.
Any impeccable soundtrack minus like all the R. Kelly that is now that's not aging super well. But
I just actually wanted to point out that he's not the best rapper, obviously, but I think probably the best NBA musician of all time. We have to shout out Wayman Tisdale, of course.
Oh, right.
Who is in the literal Jazz Hall of Fame. So,
oh, wow.
You know.
Yeah, it's hard to do. It's hard to excel that much at both. I'm personally trying to do that right now.
Yeah.
I'm on a mission.
Wayman Tisdale of podcasting and music and basketball.
Journalism. Yeah.
Yeah. trying to get into the both halls of fame at the moment. Yeah.
Wayman Tisdale, of course, who played in the NBA from 1985 to 1997, consistently always said that music was his first love over basketball. Claire, is music your first love over basketball?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
I had a feeling.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, like, I self-identify as a musician who does NBA journalism, and like, you know what I mean, like when I think of my self-image, I see myself as like an artist who's like kind of an outsider in this world and is just like here like having fun and experimenting. I don't see myself as like a NBA journalist who does music, if that makes sense.
See, when I see myself, I envision myself as the starting power forward for the Golden State Warriors, so it's pretty weird.
You can dream it, you can do it.
So will you hype up your new single that's coming out?
Yeah, oh my gosh. So my new song, Enough, is out on Golden State Entertainment on Friday, August 25th, this Friday, depending on when you're going to hear this. And it'll be available everywhere you stream music.
So. All right. Thanks a lot, Claire.
Thank you.
Where can our listeners follow you on Twitter if they don't already? I'm sure they do.
No, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at ClaireMPLS from my Minneapolis days. And yeah, you can pre-save that song and like find my music on Spotify or Apple Music or whatever under Tiny Deaths.
Great. Thanks a lot, Claire.
Thank awesome. You. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you, Claire. You can get her new single this Friday. Or I guess this will be
Entertainment.
What's today? Today's Wednesday. This will be up Thursday. So tomorrow, buy it tomorrow.
Get it. Yeah. I'm
going to
see if I can stream it on the plane.
Yeah. Every dollar spent on Claire's single goes straight to Chris Paul's pocket. So, you know, that's good. that's our episode. We're going to play Claire's song on the way out by Tiny Deaths. Before we do that, Sean, are there any plugs you want to make?
Keep reading Golden State of Mind, Giants Baseball Insider, and what's the other one I do? Yard Barker. And you can also see me. I'll be at Cobb's Comedy Club on November 9th, 10th, and 11th with Jermaine Fowler one day and Ryan Hamilton the other two.
As for me, you can always follow me on Twitter at Frankie Muniz. We're on 8/16/23. I posted a picture of myself wearing my own racing t-shirt and wrote just a picture of Frankie Muniz wearing a Frankie Muniz t-shirt. My brand new badass shirts are finally in. The first run sold out fast, but we will be printing one final batch of them.
Whoa.
So be sure to pre-order yours on MunizRacing.com. We will not be printing these again. And I've got to say, this shirt he's wearing fucking rules. Yeah. It's a skeleton wearing a Muniz Racing jumpsuit. Behind his car that looks like there might be fire on it, and it says Frankie Muniz number 30. I love it.
It's so cool.
Trust the process.
Trust the process.
And shut it down. Let's all listen to some Tiny Deaths from Golden State Entertainment.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.